Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. From humble beginnings 15 years ago as a failed top 40 DJ trying his hand at talk radio, to a host who pulls in nearly 20 million listeners a week, Rush Limbaugh became a hurricane force in right-wing talk radio. And that's about the only kind there is. Now, he's admitted drug addiction and checked into rehab, but his show and its knockoffs are still going strong. Tonight on Point, Rush Limbaugh and Right Wing Radio. But first, the Bush administration has been struggling to push through a new UN resolution that would attract international help in Iraq. The Security Council is nearing a vote. France and Germany have proposed new amendments. Earlier, I spoke with Colm Lynch, UN reporter for The Washington Post. I asked him if Washington is getting its way.
There's a number of council members who see these series of amendments as a bit of a step back by the Russians and the Germans and the French. There's no demand that the U.S. yield authority to a provisional government in the coming months. There's a lot of other kind of tinkering with the language, but there's nothing that fundamentally alters the American resolution in this draft. There is some reference to efforts to get the coalition authority to set up a specific schedule that would lay out the sequence of events leading to the transition of power to Iraqis. But by and large, most of the amendments are things that one diplomat described as manageable.
So does that mean at this point, Colin, that there's no deal breaker here? Washington is likely to get a kind of a UN sanction of its presence in and plans for Iraq, and when?
Well, they already do, in some sense, have a Security Council sanction for the administration of the country, but this would go quite a bit further than that. It is still unclear whether the Americans are willing to incorporate all of the amendments that the others have asked for, but it's looking a lot better for the Americans than it was, say, a couple of days ago when they faced stiff opposition from the UN Secretary General, who was saying, I will not send my UN staffers in to play a significant role in the country unless we have independence, unless their security on the ground. What they've done in their latest resolution is that they have provided an option for the Secretary General to delay any decision to send people into Iraq until circumstances permit, which means security is improved and the situation gets a lot better than it is right now.
Do you have a sense of why Kofi Annan has changed his posture here?
Yeah, essentially the Americans retreated significantly on its demands that the UN play not a kind of central role in the reconstruction of Iraq and the political transition, but that it had initially wanted President Bush in September had asked the UN General Assembly to have the UN play a role on the ground in creating a drafting a constitution, arranging elections, training civil servants, and this sort of thing. And the Secretary General had indicated that he wouldn't be able to do this, that the security situation wasn't stable enough. And so what this resolution says is that, you know, we'd still like you to do all those things, but we understand that you can't do this right now, and we will expect you to do it whenever you and we together determine that circumstances permit. That basically puts the issue off for sort of indefinitely.
So materially, in terms of what this would, how this would describe the months ahead in Iraq, what are the key points, Colm?
The key points are it creates a the America resolution would establish a multinational force. It would issue a direct appeal to countries to provide troops and money to help the reconstruction of Iraq. Those are questions that will not necessarily be answered by this resolution, and there's good reason to believe that although the Americans will see the resolution pass, that they won't get the troops and the money. So there's going to be a little bit of a Pyrrhic victory for the Americans in the sense that this resolution is not likely to sort of achieve the objectives they set when they first introduced it back in August.
So that was the material objective. They wanted troops and money from elsewhere. They may not get that. It also sets up a kind of timetable. Do they still have the December 15th deadline in there for the Iraqi Governing Council to come up with a further timetable for drafting a constitution and holding elections?
Yeah, I mean, essentially what that does is that is helpful to other council members in the sense that it sets a more firm sort of structure for the sequence of events leading to a transition of power. But as you said, it's a deadline to set a timetable.
But the bottom line here is the UN was holding out for the United States to give sovereignty to the Iraqis. The U.S. has not done that in this draft, but you're suggesting the Security Council is likely to support the draft anyway.
Yeah, the resolution, as you said, preserves American military power, U.S. military control over the political situation in Iraq, and the Americans have stood firm on that. It's quite clear that most of the Security Council members think this resolution is awful, and they don't like it, and they don't want to support it, but they're under enormous political pressure from the United States to do it. And I guess they need to have stronger reasons for opposing it, and the Secretary General had provided them with that, but without that kind of cover, without sort of a statement from the Secretary General saying, I won't go in, I can't go in, they've got to come up with their own excuse for not supporting it. And when they're having to deal with issues like, are we going to get a free trade agreement, there are bilateral issues that are more important to them than taking a principled stand on this resolution.
So it sounds like Washington is likely to get the resolution, but not necessarily the money or troops that were its reasons for going after the resolution in the first place.
Exactly. I mean, the timing of this resolution was to get it passed before a major donors conference in Madrid on the 23rd of October, and there were already signs that countries that aren't sort of directly involved in, you know, part of the military coalition, that they're not giving much money. And there's no reason to believe that those commitments are going to increase dramatically before the October conference.
Colm, thanks a lot for joining us.
All right, Tom.
Colm Lynch is UN reporter for The Washington Post. He spoke with us from New York. Last week, in the middle of every day, millions of Americans turned on their radios and tuned in to the self-described most dangerous man in America. And on Friday's show, from his skyscraper studio high above Penn Station in New York City, Rush Limbaugh told his audience that he was addicted to painkillers.
I am addicted to prescription pain medication. I first started taking prescription painkillers 5-6 years ago when my doctor prescribed them to treat post-surgical pain following spinal surgery. And this medication turned out to be highly addictive. Over the past several years, I've tried to break my dependence on pain pills, and in fact, I've twice checked myself into medical facilities in an attempt to do so. And I want you to know something. I'm not making any excuses, and I don't intend to. You know, over the years, athletes, celebrities have emerged from these treatment centers. They've come out to great fanfare and praise for conquering great demons. They are said to be great role models and examples for others. They've gotten a lot of praise for doing this. Well, I want you to know that I'm no role model.
He may not be a role model, but he is a trailblazer and is followed with a vengeance. When The Rush Limbaugh Show aired for the first time on August 1st, 1988, his was a relatively lonely voice of gleeful, leg-breaking conservatism on the radio dial. Now the airwaves are full of conservative pundits, bookshelves are crammed with books by and about conservative talk radio hosts, and Americans are listening in huge numbers. Rush is stepping back this week, and so will we, to ask, who is this man, what has he built, and what does it mean for American politics? Are you a Rush Limbaugh fan, or does he infuriate you? And do you listen to him even if he does? What is the core appeal of Rush Limbaugh and right-wing radio? Is it driving the country or just pretending to? And what do you think of Rush on drugs? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Paul Colford, media reporter for the New York Daily News and author of the 1994 book, The Rush Limbaugh Story, Talent on Loan from God, an Unauthorized Biography. Good evening and welcome, Paul Colford.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. Also on the line from New York is Eric Alterman, author of What Liberal Media? The Truth About Bias in the News and columnist for The Nation magazine. Good evening and welcome, Eric Alterman.
Hi, how you doing?
Great. Thanks for being with us. Paul Colford, to you first. We want to look at the big impact of Rush Limbaugh tonight, but we want to make sure that we understand the details. And if you'd be good enough to take us into the drug story first here, it just suddenly came out in the National Enquirer and then Rush Limbaugh himself on the air that he's been buying drugs at the reports are from a former housekeeper at a parking lot at a Denny's in Florida for years now. This is illegal. What's the backstory here? What's been going on?
Well, the story was rather extraordinary. I mean, from the get-go, I don't think Rush was ever considered straight-laced. He's something of a straight arrow, but he was a guy who enjoys a good cigar and a good meal, and the idea that...
And a good OxyContin, it turns out.
I'm sorry?
And a good dose of OxyContin.
So it seems. So the fact that he goes from being on page one of the National Enquirer to page one of the New York Times some days later for the same scandal of a story was really quite remarkable. And I must say that the National Enquirer, which only early this summer settled a libel suit filed against it by the wife of former Congressman Gary Condit, of whom they had written a rather incredible story that may or may not have been true, they had quite the compelling read in the case of Rush Limbaugh. I mean, their initial story about Rush's drug usage, which went on for three or four pages, was highly detailed, and it seemed bulletproof to any experienced journalist.
And he seemed to more or less confirm it on air last week. Technically, this was purchasing illegal drugs and could mean a 5-year jail sentence in Florida. Is there any indication that Rush Limbaugh is going to be prosecuted?
Well, I think he has to choose his words very carefully when it comes to the circumstances of these drug purchases. And I don't even think he's used the word purchase, but, I mean, he's obviously got high-priced legal talent in his corner in the form of Roy Black, who you may remember defended William Kennedy Smith against serious charges some years ago. And he's obviously not in any position now, or I imagine in the immediate future, to talk about the criminal elements in all this. He's really just sort of personalized the story.
Do you expect that his career will go on? It's a heck of a career. $300 million 8-year contract he signed in 2001 with a $40 million signing bonus. 600 stations he's on now, nearly 20 million listeners a week. And this from a man who dropped out of university, has been nearly bankrupt several times, fired 6 times by radio stations and other employers. Do you expect he'll be back in the saddle and back in his preeminent draw position in American radio?
Well, I do think he will be back, and I do think that there is enough invested in him, and he has enough invested in the show that he's not just going to walk away from this. And I think it's also significant to note that if you take a look, for example, at the Rush Limbaugh website, which is tied in directly to the show, there's a real drumbeat on that website in the way of letters of testimonial from priests and listeners. We're with you, Rush. We're praying for you, Rush. And also an invitation, an exhortation, if you will, to the Rush fans to contact their local affiliate and to express their support for him.
So
and if that's not directly related to the bottom line, I don't know what is.
I guess it would be. Eric Alterman, you've been an enormous critic of conservative right-wing radio, just for starters. What's your explanation of the enormous popularity of Rush Limbaugh?
Can I just say before we get started that just so people don't get the misimpression, yes, you're talking to me from New York, but I'm sitting here like everybody else, getting ready for the bottom of the ninth, rooting against the evil empire.
Hey, come on. Come on. We've got irons in all these fires. So go Sox.
I want these Yankees to go down.
Let's not get started on that.
Okay.
Rush, why so popular?
It's a very good question. Nobody really knows the answer to that question. I have my own theory, which is that what Rush and the other conservative talk radio show hosts have capitalized on is the sense of contempt that people in what we contemptuously call the flyover states feel, that they feel on the part of the major media, the guys making $8-9 million a year who read the news and dress really well and go to fancy restaurants and stuff. And even though these guys are not terribly liberal, they're quite conservative on economics.
You're talking of mainstream news anchors, not Rush Limbaugh, who dresses well, reread, and makes many more millions per year.
Right. I know. That's part of the contradiction. So does Bill O'Reilly. So does Sean Hannity. They could buy and sell the entire building that I live in, which has 40 apartments in it. But I do think that, I mean, if you look at what the conservative alternative radio and television guys are saying, it doesn't make any sense that truck drivers and working class people would go along with it because it's contrary to their economic interests in most cases.
And yet they do, and you know they do in huge numbers. Eric Alterman, Paul Colford, stand by. We'll be right back. We're talking tonight about Rush Limbaugh in the hot seat and right-wing radio's big stick in American politics. You can join the conversation. Are you a Rush fan or infuriated by Rush? What's the core appeal of Rush Limbaugh and right-wing radio? And what was your reaction when you heard that Rush Limbaugh is addicted to drugs? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about conservative talk show host Rush Limbaugh in the hot seat and right-wing radio's big sway in American politics. You can join the conversation. Is most of talk radio a vast right-wing conspiracy, or is it just more entertaining, just what people want to hear? And what does it mean that conservative talk so dominates the radio airwaves? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined from New York by Eric Alterman, media columnist for The Nation magazine and author of What Liberal Media, The Truth About Bias in the News. And from New York by Paul Colford, media columnist at the New York Daily News and biographer of Rush Limbaugh. Paul Colford, when you look at Rush's background, was this fantastic success in numbers terms preordained? It sounds like he had some trouble early on.
Well, he certainly did, and he flopped around in a series of jobs in radio before he really hit his mark and developed the niche that became as big as 600 stations or so now.
He was really a top 40 DJ? How did he cross over?
Well, he crossed over almost out of desperation. He had been out of radio for about 5 years working for the Kansas City Royals baseball team on the business side, when he was just about to be shown the door there and reacquainted himself with working in radio at a talk station in Kansas City. And it clicked. It clicked for the first time starting in 1983, 20 years ago. He was working under his own name instead of calling himself Jeff Christie or Rusty Sharp as he had in years prior. And he was able to infuriate people on the one hand and entertain them at the same time, and that was the beginning of the Rush Limbaugh radio conservative persona that we know today.
And Eric Alterman, he has brought an awful lot of imitators in his wake. They overwhelmingly dominate talk radio. Rush Limbaugh is the number one morning show in the country. I think the only bigger draw is Morning Edition on NPR, and that's quite a different thing.
But you see, you make an important point there. A lot, you say it's what the people want, but NPR has about 12 million listeners, which is comparable to Rush. Rush says he has between 15 and 20 million.
Right.
Although I'm not sure I believe it. I'd like to see some evidence.
But he's
got a lot of listeners.
He does. And the pros in radio say it's there because that's what works. That's what sells.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a very complicated question to ask why does conservatism work so much better on television, on radio, in most media except print media than does liberalism. Part of it is, no question, they're better at it. They're more entertaining. Fox News is more fun than CNN or MSNBC, even though, you know, you can't necessarily trust it. Same thing with Rush Limbaugh. There isn't anybody on the left who's that good. A second problem.
But that seems odd in itself, doesn't it? I mean, why should all the good radio jocks be conservative? That's not intuitively something you'd presume.
I don't know. It's not where talented liberals want to be. Some do, and some have tried, but it never. You know, I went into media when I was young. I never wanted to be a shock jock. You know, I wanted to get a doctorate in American history. And part of the problem is that if you ask me, when I go on, say, Crossfire to promote my last book, What Liberal Media, Tucker Carlson would say to me, Eric, in three words, answer this question. And my three-word answer was always, Tucker, read the book. Liberals are to a considerable degree paralyzed by the complexity of their worldview.
So does that make you the elite that Rush Limbaugh is always bashing?
No, it doesn't make me that elite. It does make me an elite. But I don't really have a problem with elites, per se, because societies need elites. The question is, do we have responsible elites or irresponsible elites? The idea that Rush Limbaugh is not an elite is ridiculous. The man, as you said, makes hundreds of millions of dollars. He controls the votes of possibly millions of people, and he's incredibly irresponsible. He says things that are flat-out false, that are easily disprovable.
Such as?
All the time.
I mean, we know a lot of the things he says. You know, he's on about feminazis, and the best tree is a tree that's cut up for lumber. And
he disputes the science of global warming. What the hell does Rush Limbaugh know about?
Well, the President Bush has disputed the science of global warming.
Actually, what happened was President Bush issued a report in which the EPA, not President Bush, but the EPA issued a report in which they accepted the reality of global warming, but they said they weren't going to do anything about it because it was too expensive. And then Rush Limbaugh created a big firestorm, and they withdrew the endorsement a day later.
So
Rush Limbaugh was so upset that they accepted the reality. But really, who the hell is Rush Limbaugh? Where are his scientific credentials?
So what's the bottom line, Eric Altman? You look at this from a liberal perspective. How much impact does it have? Is it shaping the nation's politics?
Impact.
Is it shaping the nation's
I tell you, it has an enormous impact because people are afraid to say things out loud that are going to be twisted and tortured by Rush Limbaugh. I mean, he went on in one program that's quoted in my book, and I tell you the truth, I can't tell if it's a joke or not, that he thought Tom Daschle was actually Satan or was an agent of Satan. It was unclear. Maybe he was kidding.
And Tom Daschle, by the way, has said that when he's attacked on Rush Limbaugh's show, the threats to his life and his family's lives spike.
Yeah, there are a lot of really angry, really frustrated, mostly white guys in this country who take their political cues from talk radio. And I got to tell you, it's very unpleasant to be their target. It's happened to me. It's not something people want to challenge. And if you want to be a national politician, it's the last thing in the world you want to. So there are a lot of unpleasant truths about our society that don't get said aloud because people are afraid of the demagogic power of talk radio.
Paul Colford, how do you see it there? Demagogues or great broadcasters somewhere?
One point that should be made, and this has nothing to do with ideology, is that Rush Limbaugh is very effective at making his show more than just Rush Limbaugh pounding the table on behalf of his conservative viewpoint. I mean, Rush Limbaugh, though he may profess to have never owned a pair of blue jeans, is certainly a child of rock and roll, and he uses, for example, music, and he uses pregnant pauses in his show and all kinds of tools of this theater of the mind called radio very effectively. And those who might just, you know, happen upon him on the dial for the first time can't help but wonder just who is this guy and stay tuned for longer than they might ordinarily. He's a very effective communicator, and he's also someone who entertains while he is beating the table on behalf of the president or on behalf of any political point of view. What separates him from just someone who is all screed, if you will.
No question. Eric Altman, I know we have to let you go in just a minute, but let me ask you this. If conservatives are so much better at doing radio, and if it is as consequential as you say, then can the Democrats ever really get back in power with this great big conservative radio juggernaut out there?
Well, I think they need to be challenged on their own ground, no question. I mean, you don't like to say this out loud, but it's true. The conservatives are right that most people who work at NPR are liberals. Otherwise, why would you work there? You could make more money in commercial radio. But that doesn't make NPR a liberal.
Well, you might be a journalist, and not every talk radio host is a journalist.
Well, it's true. But the point is that there are some just down-the-line people who work at NPR. But there are very few conservatives there, and there are an awful lot of liberals. But they're not creating a liberal station. They're creating what they believe to be is a professional newscast that is fair to both sides, that is as objective as they know how to be. And that's what appeals to liberal journalists. Liberal journalists, as Grover Norquist says in the book, are journalists first and liberals second, whereas conservatives are conservatives first and journalists second. And that field, I'm afraid, has been seeded for too long, and liberals have paid the price for it, and it's going to be very hard to recover because there just isn't a talent bench out there. Paul is right. The conservatives are just are talented and more entertaining than liberals, and I don't know where you get the training. There are efforts now to start a liberal talk radio station. There are efforts. Al Gore is trying to start a liberal cable station, even though he's not calling it that. There's now a new liberal sort of heritage foundation, which I'm a fellow of, called the Center for American Progress. So liberals have woken up to the fact that they've fallen very far behind in this kind of agitation and this kind of fighting the battle of ideas in a mass way. But they're so far behind, it's going to be a long time before they can catch up. They're pretty much in the position that conservatives were in when Barry Goldwater lost the election in 1964, and they're just about starting from scratch.
So being trounced so far, even trounced by a rush on drugs. Eric Alterman, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Eric, and go Sox, by the way. Eric Alterman is author of What Liberal Media, The Truth About Bias in the News. Let's turn to our callers. Chris is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, I just wanted to call in as somebody who is definitely on the far left side of the political spectrum. Nevertheless, I actually really enjoy listening to Rush Limbaugh and a few of the other conservatives. But
and what is it exactly about Rush that gets you, Chris, that gets you listening?
Well, it's interesting. Part of it is sort of an anthropological curiosity about these sort of strange cigar-smoking, you know, far-right conservatives and what's going on with them. And more so, it's sort of like, I mean, Rush talks about the left's playbook and using the same playbook, and it's kind of getting into the how the enemy thinks and from a competitive spirit, understanding their playbook and what's going on there. And but also, I mean, I will grant there's mention the entertainment factor. I mean, politicians, be it, you know, Clinton, Gore, or Daschle, I mean, or on the far right, they tend to be flawed creatures, and people who can, you know, ridicule them effectively are, you know, there's real entertainment value there.
So what do you think about the political bottom line, Chris? If you're a lefty but you love listening or to Rush, you're part of what puts together his $300 million pay package and saturates the airwaves with Rush and Rush wannabes. Where does that leave the country politically?
Well, all I can say is, I mean, after listening for several years, I still would never vote for a far-right candidate. I'd never vote for a Republican that I can imagine. So it hasn't changed my voting, at least. I mean, there is a concern about, you know, advertising dollars supporting a cause there. But I think, you know, so long as both sides are out there on the airwaves, you know, I think I don't have a lot of guilt about that.
So you're entertained, but still coming down where you started politically. Chris, thanks for your call. I want to welcome into our conversation Michael Harrison. He's joining us from Springfield, Massachusetts. He's editor and publisher of Talkers Magazine, a trade publication serving the talk radio industry. Good evening and welcome, Michael Harrison.
It's nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So how did you take on board the news last week of Rush Limbaugh's drug addiction, and what do you think it means for his career?
Well, I mean, obviously, his career will be hurt if his life is hurt physically. There's two levels to this. The personal level, who knows? It's a very difficult thing to face that type of addiction. And if, in fact, he physically and mentally is not able to overcome it, well, that's the end of, you know, his business career as we know it. But if he's able to somehow overcome this problem or come to grips with it or manage it, even as a chronic illness, if you will. I know this sounds strange, but it actually will up his stock.
Will up his stock? You don't think it's a bruise on his reputation?
No,
why up
no,
his
because,
stock? Why?
Because I'm listening to the conversation, and the basic premise here is that somehow his reputation and his credibility are the key to his success. And he's not a member of the clergy. He's not an elected official.
Though he's passed judgment like a high priest. I mean, he's said that anybody who uses drugs should go up the river. Yeah.
But he's an entertainer. Mm-hmm. He really is. You have to understand, you know, you talked about saturate. You used the word saturated. The air is saturated with Rush Limbaugh. It's not. If you look at the actual numbers, most people in the United States have never heard Rush Limbaugh. Most voters have never heard Rush Limbaugh. Most radio listeners have never heard Rush Limbaugh.
Well, yeah, but things are moved at the margin. You and I know that. And it's not just Rush Limbaugh, I'll concede. It's Rush and the many others in the right-wing category. But as far as radio goes, you'd have to say it's saturated. I mean, I saw one report, 300 hours per week on the biggest 45 stations of the top conservative talk show hosts, 5 hours of Democrat or liberal, whatever you want to call it, talk show on those same stations.
Well, again, you're not looking at all the total hours of number of hours on radio, and it's a far smaller percentage than you would think.
Hmm.
I'm not diminishing its importance.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is Rush Limbaugh's success does not come from his credibility as a political commentator, but rather as a fascinating character on the radio. And as many people that listen to him because they love him, there are as many people who listen to him because they hate him. And some people just listen because they're amused. So to answer your question, if he's able to overcome the physical problem and the mental mental problem of a real life situation, a real life situation. His fantasy life as a talk show host will actually have a chance to be reinvigorated and reinvented by the fact that so many people are going to hear what the heck he has to say for himself.
I want to ask you something. Rush Limbaugh, you know, can riff in a very wild fashion sometimes. He says he's been on prescription drugs, illegal prescription drugs, for 5 or 6 years. How much of that do you think was OxyContin talking?
I don't know. I would say, though, that you have to really do consider the fact that he might not be in his total right mind if he is addicted. And that's a good point you make.
That sounds tough. Let me take a call here. Alex is calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Alex, are you there? Oh, I think that was Alex we just lost. Let's turn to Eric calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Eric. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Great, thanks.
Oh, great. Yeah, well, I just wanted to call to tell you that I can remember the very first time I ever heard Rush Limbaugh on the radio. I mean, I was like that last gentleman was talking about where, you know, a lot of people aren't aware of him. Well, I came across him by complete accident. I bought an old truck, and it only had an AM radio, and I hadn't listened to AM radio in probably 20 years at that point.
You and millions of others, maybe.
Well, yeah, so I turned this thing on, had no idea even where the stations were, and I hear this guy talking, and I thought, hey, this guy is really funny. I had a great time listening to him for about 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And then I realized, well, wait a minute. There's callers calling in, and they sound serious. How could that be? This guy's a fruitcake.
Well, but he's ministering to people who want to hear what he's delivering. What do you think of Rush Limbaugh's politics, Eric?
They're appalling. I mean, you know, to me, it is pure entertainment. And, you know, I think that there is a certain element to this whole thing that he keeps this whole facade going. I mean, I wouldn't doubt it in the least that half the people that call in are people that are prompted, you know, just to keep this whole strange.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, he's got millions of listeners. I'm sure he gets plenty of calls that come in one way or another. But you were entertained until you weren't. But do you still listen, Eric?
Oh no, I every once in a while I'll just turn it on for about 2 minutes. Is about all that I can stand, and I hear this stuff, and it's like, oh my God, yeah, it's real.
Got it, Eric. Thanks for your call, Michael Harrison. What are the trend lines on right wing or conservative talk radio? Is it still in the ascendant?
It's a popular form of talk radio. It has a very, very large core audience. All of talk radio is growing at a slower pace than it did during the 90s because it's gotten to such a high point. There aren't that many stations left to go talk, and it's one of the most popular commercial formats of radio in America. So, yeah, it's still growing, but it's already enjoyed most of its growth in terms of percentage of growth per year. But it's a popular form of radio that has its audience. It's not all of radio, and it's not the only form of radio. And I think that's a key point to be made in this conversation, that Rush Limbaugh does not dominate all of radio. He's a popular person. It's like when the Beatles were making records. They had a number of hits on the charts, but there were other artists, too, and other forms of music.
Yeah, but I guess if you're as big as the Beatles, that's a lot to sway a lot of spectrum and maybe a lot of minds. Michael Harrison, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about Rush Limbaugh in the hot seat and right-wing radio's big sway in American politics. You can join the conversation. Are Rush and company charlatans, or are they in-your-face truth-tellers? And is American political debate held hostage or grounded by the right-wing shock jocks? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Rush Limbaugh in the hot seat and right-wing radio's big sway in American politics. You can join the conversation tonight. What does it mean that conservative talk so dominates the radio airwaves? If Rush is so bad, why is he so popular? And if he's so brilliant, why is he so divisive? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been talking tonight with Michael Harrison. He's editor and publisher of Talkers Magazine, a trade publication serving the talk radio industry. We're joined now from Northern California by Robert Scheer, syndicated columnist at the Los Angeles Times and co-author of the upcoming book, The Five Biggest Lies That Bush Told Us About Iraq. Good evening and welcome, Robert Scheer.
You know, I just wanted to ask Mr. Harrison a question.
Yes, please.
Wouldn't the ratings suffer if Rush is in jail?
If Rush is in jail, then the ratings will suffer unless he broadcasts from jail, and then most people would probably want to see what that's like.
So Michael Harrison's got his eye on the show biz.
Well, I have to have my eye on the show biz because it is show biz, and I'm not here presenting a political point of view.
We've got it. Robert Scheer, what's your point in the question exactly?
The whole assumption of the previous discussion that I was listening to is that somehow a serious crime is not involved, and most individuals in this country faced with this question of buying a large number of prescription drugs, maybe having involved his housekeeper in committing a crime, would be afraid of the penalty, not their ratings, but are they going to jail?
But you yourself have written, Robert Scheer, in your last column, the headline is Free Rush Limbaugh.
Yeah,
you say despite that and the Donovan McNabb comments that got him out of ESPN, you're ready to give a green light for more Rush.
Well, I don't mind more Rush. I believe in free speech, and I'm also against the drug laws. But I do think this sort of be a time when we consider those laws, and is this guy going to be treated differently than other people would be?
It's a felony in Florida.
Treated differently than he would have wanted other people. After all, he's someone who said you should go up the river for this kind of behavior. It seems to me if he recovers and if he doesn't go to jail, he has some sort of obligation at least to become an anti-drug law crusader or explain why his treatment worked and why medical treatment is good for him, but prison time is required for others. And I think it's also a question that should be thrown to his political allies. This guy has been a guest in the White House of both Bushes, and he's very close to the Republican establishment. They don't treat him as a fringe person. So if he's that mainstream in the Republican Party, seems to me reporters ought to be asking the president, what do you make of this? And should we throw the book at Rush, or should he be allowed to have treatment? If so, shouldn't the drug laws be changed? That's, to my mind, the important question.
When John Ashcroft is out there saying no plea bargaining, throw the full sentence at anybody who comes before them. And Rush Limbaugh said, as you quote him, 1995, too many whites are getting away with drug use. The answer is to go out and find the ones who are getting away with it, convict them, and send them up the river, too.
Right.
Straightforward.
No, I don't want to send, as I said in the column, I don't want to send him up the river, but I don't want to send anybody up the river. I do think we should not have criminalized drug usage. However, if he used his housekeeper and he in any way pressured her, maybe at the possible loss of her job or something.
Well, I think it was a former housekeeper.
Narco underworld and go out and buy the drugs, then he's got a much more serious legal challenge here.
And Robert Scheer, if that should be the case, or in any case, what do you think of this kind of free-floating right-wing radio world? Everyone's expecting in this conversation tonight that Rush Limbaugh will come back, and if he's not somehow doesn't have a debilitating drug problem, he'll be back on the air. Michael Harrison thinks he'll be even more popular. What's up with the politics that float that, or is that the proof that it's not about politics at all? It really is about entertainment.
Well, it is about politics because Rush and O'Reilly and these people are very useful to the more restrained Republican establishment, and they can muddy the waters. They can ignore all the time. You know, you're out of work, it's the government's fault, but it's the Democrats' fault. Not the Republicans' fault.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't find the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. It's the media's fault. So what they are able to do is, as I say, muddy the waters so people don't, you know, see clearly. And as a result, then the Republican establishment gets more votes and people vote against their interests. I think they have a tremendous political impact. I would agree, though, that the dominant culture in this country tends to be pro-market, libertarian, against harassing people. Most of the polls would show on the drug question that they don't want it criminalized. And actually, most of the polls now show that Bush is not popular. So, you know, we can exaggerate the impact of these talk show characters, but they certainly play an important role, and they get a lot of votes out for the Republican Party. And that's why I think some of these questions should be put back to the president and to the rest of the Republican leadership. This was your guy. You stood behind him.
Mm-hmm.
What do you make of this? Does this make you think differently about drug addicts, junkies? After all, by his own admission, he was a junkie.
Yep.
This was not some minor little habit that he had. And he was on it for quite a while. And I suspect the Republican leadership, might want to rethink their drug policies.
Fat chance, but it will be fascinating to see how Rush Limbaugh comes back and with what line. LJ is calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Hi, LJ. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing tonight?
Great. Great, thanks.
I'm a listener in Kentucky. I'm also a gentleman that's blind, so I listen to a lot of talk radio, also surf the net and so forth. A couple of comments and my major point. It's very easy to speak from the other side of the fence of addiction. Myself was formerly addicted to cocaine, pills, marijuana, and alcohol,
mm-hmm.
and have been sober for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a strong Christian at this point, and I don't agree with some things Russ says. And when he came out to endorse Schwarzenegger, which he pretty much did, I was pretty shocked. Schwarzenegger is a very moderate, that's a big, nice Republican, if you will. He has some very strong left-wing positions. However, what to me would show the most class and the most ethic for those on the left is just leave the guy alone. I mean, what's they going to gain their position by continuing to slam the right? See, one of the biggest problems I see as a young moderate, you know, is that I want to hear some solutions from Democrats. I'm sick up to my ears of hearing about all the problems with the right. See, that doesn't fix anything.
But you know, LJ, and if you listen to that much talk radio, you know this is true. There's an avalanche of right-wing radio criticism of the Democrats and the left. Now, I'm not saying we don't need solutions. Clearly, we do. But when you've got an administration that's been so hard on the prosecution side, as John Ashcroft has been, and Rush Limbaugh has been very supportive of that, and here they've got sort of Exhibit A with one of their most prominent public supporters who's been breaking the law with drugs. Are you saying
sure.
just turn a blind eye?
Well, no, of course not. Oh, blind eye, come on now.
Forgive me. Forgive
I'm
me.
Kidding.
I'm counting on your sense of humor there.
No,
I guess.
But seriously, our country was found on innocent until proven guilty. And whether Rush is a Democrat or Republican, or I mean, obviously, but you know, all the facts are not out yet. And I believe if the facts do come out that there is a pattern here of, you know, of what would meet the laws of the felony, so forth, prosecute with due process. Of course, we've had too much of sweetheart deals in the back rooms of drugs. Some people do a lot of drugs and don't get caught. Some do small things and get caught and get busted, you know. And
so it could come to something tough, but doesn't sound like you expected. LJ, thanks for your call. Michael Harrison, in the world of big radio personalities and entertainers in general, drug use often gets overlooked. Do you expect anything different for Rush Limbaugh?
It all depends on what the facts are. And in response to what Mr. Scheer said about we're not talking about how jail will affect him or whatever, this gentleman who just called really hit the nail on the head. In America, you're innocent until proven guilty.
Mm-hmm.
And there is an investigation going on. And we really don't have all the facts. I mean, most of the facts that have been presented in terms of the crime aspect of this were in the National Enquirer. So
the state attorney, Barry Krischer in Florida, the spokesman there, said on Friday that they would not confirm or deny whether Limbaugh himself was under investigation.
So it's at that point that it's really difficult to say, you know, anything and speculating about the criminality of it. But, hey, if in fact he can be in serious, serious trouble, and that will effectively end his career because you can't really have a show business or a political career, whichever side of the line you're looking at Rush from, when you're in prison for 30 years.
That would be tough. Alex is calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Alex. You're on the air.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Loud and clear, Alex.
Excellent. Hey, I think that Rush Limbaugh is really popular in general just because, you know, he's coming from an entertainment point of view. I don't think that you know, he could actually be on the left side if he, you know, with his knowledge background in entertainment and just be as exciting. But I think the right is feeding more into some of the problems that people are, you know, really unhappy with in the country in general.
So you're saying he could put it either way, but he does speak politically, and it's I mean that ultimately can't be taken away from the entertainment quality that he brings.
And true, but I think that a lot of people in America are really upset with a lot of the different problems, and I think he's just feeding into that.
Can I jump
in? He can find a lot of, you know, statistics and facts to back it up, even though I do think he twists them and it contorts them pretty badly. You know, he's basically doing it from an entertainment perspective, and he's not like Kobe Bryant where, you know, his image is tarnished forever. You know, a lot of the money he's making on the sales or using his name on something has to do with a wholesome image. And Rush Limbaugh doesn't have to be wholesome at all.
Well, he doesn't have to be wholesome, but boy, consistency is strained here with a man who has said on air repeatedly over the years what Rush Limbaugh has said. Michael Harrison, I heard you there, and thanks for your call, Alex.
I find it interesting because we try to maintain a nonpartisan view at Talkers Magazine so that we can function with all the different points of view in our business, but it sounds to me as though you're just making the assumption that Rush's political position is completely invalid and that somehow he represents something that really shouldn't be on the radio.
Oh, not at all. Far from it. It's,
I'm getting that impression.
I think the point is, the question is, what is it about radio that has made Rush and the other right-wing talkers so overwhelmingly dominant and popular?
Easy answer.
Robert Scheer, please.
First of all, let me clear something up. I not only believe and prove innocent until guilty, even if he's guilty, I don't want him to go to jail, okay?
Mm-hmm. And we've read that. We got it.
And that is a solution, by the way. When you say we don't have solutions, one solution to overcrowded jails would not be to not jail people for what are essentially victimless crimes. But as far as the radio, if I'm driving in the car, I don't want to pander to you, but there's I would listen to NPR, or I listen to music. I listen to my CD.
Yeah.
And I suspect that the people who are going to talk radio maybe are people who don't appreciate music. There may be a distinct minority of listeners who want to hear this yakety yak.
It is a minority.
Yeah.
It is a minority, and radio is a niche medium. Mr. Scheer made a very good point. As I said earlier, too, the reason it's successful is because conservative talk radio has spent the last 14, 15 years cultivating a niche that appreciates that particular point of view. They super serve them. They do it in an entertaining way with very talented personalities, and they've cultivated a tremendous amount of loyalty because there are many people who feel they're not getting that point of view in all the other media from beyond radio, from Hollywood, from newspapers, from television, and so they really serve a need, but it's not a majority of the people in this country listening to it because you don't need a majority to be successful in radio.
But it goes like gangbusters even with that very, very large majority. Robert Scheer, you know, there's all this talk about building a liberal radio response to the right-wing radio world. Can you imagine that flourishing?
Well, it's already happened with the bestsellers list. For a while there, it was only these right-wing guys that were dominating. Now you have Al Franken and Joe Connison and a lot of other people having bestsellers. Hopefully our five biggest lies of the Bush administration will be such a bestseller. But, you know, basically I think Mr. Harrison is making a very good point. The dominant culture in this country is a permissive one. It is also a liberal one. The reason Schwarzenegger got in was precisely because he is a moderate. He didn't frighten many California voters. He is pro-choice, for instance. I suspect he's against jailing people for personal use of drugs. He is a moderate on the social issues. And I think it's no good to get overly frightened by the Rush Limbaughs of this world. They represent a kind of sad sack loser element, which he himself seems to have been. The descriptions of how he lives in his $25-30 million mansion, you know, just sitting there watching couch potato, watching football, very few friends. And it seems that, you know, perhaps one of the reasons he went to drugs, he's a rather lonely guy who then has this other personality he puts on radio. Maybe that's also true of a lot of his listeners.
Well, he switches it on bright. Maybe they do as well. Robert Scheer, thanks so much for joining us tonight. Robert Scheer, syndicated columnist at the Los Angeles Times and co-author of the upcoming book, The Five Biggest Lies That Bush Told Us About Iraq. And Michael Harrison, editor and publisher of Talkers Magazine. Thanks a lot for being with us.
My pleasure.
You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.